Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM with Gillette. When we show our best side, we don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
Game on 2FM.
Thanks to Chris and Kira. Chris could do with a rest after that competition. It's Monday, the 18th of May, and this is Game On.
Coming up today, golf is back on our screens and our courses, and we check how happy this made Paul McGinley.
We explore Daniel Kinahan's increasing influence in the world of boxing.
Because everybody trusts Kinahan. Dan is like the captain when it comes to the practicalities of doing a fight in the Mideast.
Plus in soccer, Premier League clubs get the OK to return to training and Celtic are crowned champions of Scotland.
Game on 2FM.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at Game On as we try to entertain you for the next hour. Guys, sport was back. Live sport, not replays now, Marie, watching the Sunday game stuff from yesteryear. And it was, I suppose it was an invitational, but at least it was live sport last night. Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, Matthew Wolff. At least you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, and I'll throw in as well the Bundesliga, same thing. It was really exciting to see it coming back, to actually sit down and turn on the TV, watch a team running out. Okay, there was nobody there, but still, just to go through the motions that you'd usually experience watching on a Saturday afternoon, and just seeing them warming up and getting ready and observing the new protocol, seeing the subs with their masks on, sitting their required distance apart, and then seeing some good football as well.
Yeah, it's a first step, isn't it? It seems like it's a long way to go. But as you're saying, Ruby, the main thing, you didn't know the result. There was like, and I must say, I really enjoyed the golf. The mics on the players, genius idea. Why don't they do that the whole time and show off their calves?
It's not great if you don't have a good personality, though.
It doesn't even have to boil down to personality. That was an invitation. It was for a charity. So you're standing there on the first tee on the final round on Sunday at the Masters, and some fellas, a mic stuck on you, and you're thinking, like, I'm under pressure, I don't really want to talk. This microphone, I want to throw it in the lake, and that's what's going to happen. Sport, at the end of the day, sports people are sports people. They're not comedians, they're not entertainers. And the lads didn't try to be comedians yesterday, which I thought was a big thing. They had the bit of banter they had, but no one tried to be a comedian.
Wasn't a fan of the banter, Ruby. Wasn't a fan.
The banter was terrible. They could do with lessons, couldn't they?
But that's what they are. They're not trying to be somebody they're not. At least they didn't try to be people that they weren't.
Yeah, true. I still think there's something in the mics. I really did enjoy just getting the inside track on it. I think they...
Oh, yeah. So when, I don't know, Jamie Heaslip had you by the back of the head in the bottom of a ruck, you'd love to be mic'd up, would you?
Well, no. It's not right for rugby.
No.
And it's not right for rugby because of the slagging, one, but also because of the collision noises. Because there was a game, CJ Standler wore the oh, look at him.
Oh, don't bring it into my game, bring it into their game if you want, but don't bring it into ours.
Yeah, they're out wearing nice polos and having a great day.
That's typical ex-sports person. Yeah, whatever you do, don't bring it to our game, give it to everybody else.
There was a lot of negativity about the lack of fan noise and atmosphere at the football, but I think by the time the Bayern Munich game rolled around on Sunday evening, I was kind of used to it. And I think people are being overly critical because there is no other option. The only other option is to have no football. So I think what we got and how it played out was pretty okay for our first weekend of football.
I thought the same. I was actually reading the Sunday papers yesterday as well, and I picked out one quote in the back of them, and it was, the reality is we are now already living post-COVID-19 lives. This is what we have to get used to. This is the new normal. Empty stadiums, golf course with nobody at them, racetracks that are empty. This is post-COVID-19, and this is going to be the normality.
Can I make a recommendation as well? If you watch it with your family, it's good because, like, my family provided the atmosphere, so they were roaring and shouting and jumping up and down and imitating the celebrations, and it was good old crack. We were all in it.
It's a good idea. If you had a Zoom camera now on your place going crazy, there's your supporters. You could see people going nuts as well. I think it would be a good call.
That isn't bad, because we were watching the golf last night and the little 3-year-old wanted Ricky Fowler to win, and he was shouting, orange. So there you go. Great atmosphere in our house.
What about the questions? Why did he do that? Why did that happen? Why did he do that? And why did that happen? How long are you going to be able to listen to that?
That could be an issue, all right, but I mean, I'll get used to it.
Do you know what I noticed, though, Marie, and you're not going to like me for saying that? I think it's fine for professional sports people. They can go out and it's their job. But I just think, I honestly think hurling and football without the emotion of a crowd could be so, so flat. I just think it lifts players to play beyond themselves. And it's grand for 22 professional players in Germany, but you've seen such magical days in Croke Park or in Munster, Munster finals or whatever it was. I wonder without a crowd, is it the same?
Look, it's never going to be the same. It's never going to be what we had. But if it's all we got, then that's fair enough. And I have been at plenty of matches where there haven't been a lot of people there. And OK, look, I'm going to be straight up about it. A lot of them were women's sports matches and they didn't have massive crowds in them. And there were early stages of championship or league or the women's FAI Cup final is played at 12 o'clock in the day in front of an empty Aviva stadium. The girls still give it everything. So I just think that thinking that the players aren't going to invest the same amount of emotion in it, it's selling them a little bit short, because when I have seen some of these games, they've been fantastic and they haven't been packed to the rafters.
I can't have that done again. What kind of crowds were at the underage games when you were a kid?
There wouldn't have been a whole lot, but I think going out there on Saturday in the Bundesliga, it was clinical, wasn't it? It was just real. There was no, the football was good, but I just didn't think there was any emotion in it. And I think that's what separates Irish sport sometimes. And I think for the best days in sport, I do think you need the emotion of the crowd. And as long as the crowd isn't there, I think, I totally agree, Marie, we're going to see great games, but I don't know, will we get... I just know myself, there's a tie-in sometimes when you play in front of a big crowd, you play in front of people you care about and love, and it can actually force you to be a better player.
But that is not an option. And by saying that amateur players shouldn't come back and play while they can't have crowds, you're taking away their sport, you're taking away the thing that they love and the thing that they've worked really hard for. And these people have short careers and they want to go and play.
I was professional, Dunica, and I rode in plenty of empty race courses where there was nobody, and you had to go about your job and do it in this a professional manner on the days there was no one there as when there was 70,000 people there. And I don't accept that. I think it's easier
for pros, Ruby, because I've been there as well, and we saw it at the weekend. Pros will just, it's like going to your dentist, it's like going to your doctor.
But GAA players are essentially pros. Like, they're doing everything that
remember
they're amateur.
That statement now, the next time she says, oh, but they can't because they're amateur. She just said they're essentially
when
pros.
When it comes
right,
to their training.
Down, Duncan, remember that one.
When it comes to their training and their preparation, and like they put in 30 hours a week, that's as much as any pro player. So if they're putting in that time and they're going out to play a game, and okay, they might not have their family in the crowd, but they'll know their family are there and they'll know that they're representing their county and they'll know that they're giving people something to watch, and it'll be the only thing that we'll have. And I 100% feel that they would rise to the occasion. It won't be perfect, but I just think that they'd still be able to do it.
If you're playing for the crowd, you're not playing for yourself. And if you're not playing for yourself, you shouldn't really be out there. You should be playing for yourself and what it means to you, and you should be able to get up for that if there's nobody watching.
No, I don't know, Ruby, like that. I went to that Limerick-Galway game and it was like nothing I've ever been at before for emotional tie between the pitch and the players. They were a representation of what was on the pitch. And I think
they will be. They'll all be watching it from home.
Yeah, they will be.
Well, it might be, because it won't be on anyway.
Because the only other option is not to have GAA. And like that might mean there might not be crowds back till 2022. Like, how could you go two years without GAA then?
Well, they won't be back until social distancing is gone. You heard John Horn saying that last week, so I wouldn't worry about it, Marie.
Donica, stop trying to take away my GAA.
No, I wanted to. I just worry that it won't hit the heights that we're all so used to, and that I think that would be unfair to them.
Well, won't. Like, it will never be the same without crowds there. Mm. But it is definitely better than nothing.
I agree.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, lads, let's take a break and we'll be back with Paul McGinley. He might have something to say on the GAA. Welcome back to Game On. Unsurprisingly, our conversation at the top of the show has garnered great interest and lots of texts, most of them disagreeing with us. The Bundesliga was a huge, big load of horse manure, said this texter. And we have another one in. Empty stadiums will not be the norm. We'll be back this time next year.
Yep. Interesting to hear what you have to say. 51552.
Don't forget to plug
love that person's
later.
Optimism that we'll all still be here this time next year. That's what you got to have. Positivity.
It's you.
No holding him back.
Someone's put a penny in him. Life's for it and he's back. It's the good news that racing's back. June the 8th. I'd say you can't wait, Ruby.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. June the 8th, and even the programme is released during the week, and we'll have the Guineas that first weekend on June 12th and 13th. The Irish Derby will be on June 27th. The Oaks on July the 8th. Champion Stakes will be September 12th and 13th. Yeah, it'll be great. And it looks, look, initially there'll only be 9 race courses in use, and hopefully they'll get around to using them all by the time July comes around. But it will be, there'll be some great action, and I can't wait for it. These will have live sport, and people won't bemoan empty stadiums. They'll be happy to be there.
God, this optimism.
You will. It's
on
only around the corner. The first one's in Nace.
Ruby, are you going to take up golf now that it's back? Or are you going to play more golf?
Am I going to play more golf? No, I'm a casual golfer. I am a member in my course, which is less than 5 kilometres away, so I could play, and I probably will play around the golf, but
disclaimer.
I'm a pretty average golfer, Marie.
All right. Well, you do have some people that you can talk to about and get some advice.
We do. I was sitting down watching it last night, so I text Paul McGinley to see if he would join us, and he is here. Paul, how are you?
I'm grand, Ruby, not too bad. How are you?
We were having a raging debate, Paul, there a minute ago about the GAA before we get into golf and whether it should be on behind closed doors or not. As a Dublin fan, would you like to see the Dubs get a go at winning 6 in a row?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think we've got a little alternative, really. I mean, you know, I can't see any government anywhere in the world endorsing big crowds of people gathering unless there's a vaccine or better medical procedures that don't cost people lives in place. I think that's the reality we got to face. So we have a choice, clear. Do you want to see sport without crowds and, you know, all of the medical procedures adhere to and social distancing and everything? Or do we just kind of wait and say, let's wait till next year and hopefully we have a vaccine by then? I mean, it's a... I haven't made up my mind on it yet, to be honest, Ruby. I mean, I watched a bit of the golf last night, and there's no doubt it is soulless. There's no doubt. It's going to be very difficult to watch sport without crowds and atmosphere. I mean, you know as well as anybody, it's, you know, the excitement of the crowd gets the adrenaline going and gets excitement, and you know, that's what kind of jumps the pictures off TV is the adrenaline of the atmospheric. Kind of feeling that you get from watching sport because of the noise.
And you watched the guys playing in Seminole yesterday. Look, they were obviously hadn't played in a while and some were a bit rusty, but I must say I enjoyed not knowing what was going to happen. Even though the longest drives, obviously Matt Wolf outdrove the lads, and even on the 17th when Rory got that putt to halve the skin, it was the anticipation. I did enjoy that all the same.
Yeah, I didn't, to be honest. I thought it was, you know, it was done for good reasons. I understand what they were doing. But I loved the cut and thrust, the real competitiveness. And I thought it was a little bit too friendly, a bit too soft yesterday. You know, and the real competitiveness nature of sport is what certainly draws me to it more than anything else. And I thought it lacked it yesterday. That's not saying I didn't enjoy it or wouldn't watch it. I understand it was being played for different reasons. And it was also, from a golf's point of view, it was almost like a precursor to what's going to happen on June 11 when the first tournaments come back for real. It was like a trial run, seeing what it would be like in terms of getting it on TV, players doing the social distancing and all the kind of things that they're probably going to have to do on June 11 when it comes back to being a full event on the PGA Tour. So it was a good kind of pre-rider for that, and obviously a huge amount of money raised for all the health services.
Paul, we did see the winner in Rory McIlroy. When it really mattered, you know, he stepped up.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've been saying for a while now, as a close watcher of Rory's career since he was kind of 16 years of age, this is the best I've ever seen him play. I know he's won majors in the past, but in terms, if you look underneath his performances, his statistics are phenomenal. Parts of his game that used to be considered weak, his putting in particularly, used to be a streaky putter. He used to be a streaky player. We can't say that about Rory anymore. There's nobody more consistent than McIlroy at the moment. He's churning out top fives the whole time. He's winning regularly. Yes, he hasn't won major championships yet, but I've no doubt that they're coming. I think we're seeing them now in the prime of his career, and there's a maturity about how he plays the game now that he mightn't have had even when he was winning majors. So I think it's a matter of time. And if he wins one, I think the floodgates, he could have a flutter of three or four in a short space of time.
Paul, we mentioned at the top of the show how difficult it is for players to rise to the occasion when they don't have the fans and the atmosphere that is there. It looks like it is going to be like it was last night for quite a little while to come. How do you think Rory will play in a situation like that, in a different situation?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. It's going to be different for everybody. Mental engagement is going to be the hard bit, because you're not going to have the crowd there to create the atmosphere. So you've got to be really motivated personally yourself. You got to come out of the blocks quick. Nobody's going to be pushing you forward. You can't wait for the crowd to push you forward. And everywhere McAvoy plays now, he's used to having big crowds around him. It's part and parcel of being the world number one and the superstar that he is. So it might take some adjustment for him. And the answer lies within. The answer lies within his own personal motivations. He can still win tournaments and add to his CV. And that remains to be seen. We can't answer that question. It'll be interesting to see, though. It's a really good question, and I'm looking forward to seeing how he deals with this new norm, as they call it.
When you think about that logic, Paul, with not having the crowd to motivate players, could that suit the younger, hungrier, keener lads who are trying to prove a point? Could we see some unfamiliar faces getting up the leaderboards in the PGA Tour?
Yeah, I think so. I think it would, yeah. I think it's certainly going to help them. And if the Ryder Cup is going to be played... behind closed doors, I mean, that's certainly going to help the European team with no American crowd shouting in your ear. So there's a lot of, as they say, these new norms that are going to happen in sport. You know, I'm pretty sure the Premier League is going to start at some stage as well. And what's it going to be like for teams in that as well? I mean, there's so many unknowns out there in sport. We're just going to have to view it through a different lens. And it's also going to be interesting to see how players deal with it and how teams deal with it and how managers deal with it. Because the script has never been written before. It's not like you can go back and, you know, copy something that might have happened a year or two before in these circumstances. You know, it's very rare that the team has played behind closed doors, if at all. And it's very rare that a golfer would have played without anybody watching. So, yeah, there's a lot to be learned, and that's going to be one of the interesting dynamics to observe and watch.
How do you think you'd cope in a situation like that?
How would I cope? I've never been one of the superstars of the game who attracted huge crowds. You know, I think it will be a little bit normal. You see, one of the things about professional golf is that people don't, you know, when you're watching on TV, you're generally watching the guys who are in contention, and that's where the big crowds are. Or you're watching the superstars over the first 2 days who are in the TV groups, and again, that's where the crowds are. But if you're down the list, you know, the point that was made earlier, if you're down the list in terms of, one of the bottoms, you know, it's 150 guys in the field and you're not part of the top 50, generally you don't play with crowds. You play with one man and a dog watching, and it's only when you get in contention, unless you're a superstar, that you actually play with the crowd. So it won't be too unfamiliar for a lot of golfers. And the point about somebody coming up on the rails that we don't expect, and being more comfortable without having that big intimidation factor around, and that big atmosphere around, could well help some of the lesser lights.
Paul, obviously June 11th is the scheduled restart for the PGA. The European Tour is a bit behind that. But here today, all the golf courses reopen for members to play. Do you think many courses that play in that way, with no green fees, no bars, that opening golf courses will be financially viable for clubs?
Yeah, you know, it's a really tough question. You know, one of the things that, you know, has not been talked about a huge amount yet is the economic fallout on the back of this 2 month hiatus that we've had in the world. A lot of golf clubs, a lot of tours around the world, a lot of organizations within the golfing industry, they're non-profit. You know, they run from year to year. They don't run with a huge mountain of cash on account for a rainy day. So obviously cash flow is going to be big issues for those. I'm talking about a lot of golf clubs in particular. And I think we're going to see, unfortunately, a lot of golf clubs go to the wall, and a lot of golf clubs have big cash flow problems. I think that's going to be one of the consequences of this. Once you come out the other side of the virus, it's not like we're out of the woods at that stage. I think there's going to be some big consequences going forward. So I'm glad that golf is back. We're very fortunate that it is a sport that we can practice the guidelines that the government have put in place in terms of social distancing. It's a non-contact sport as well, which helps against what you were talking to earlier about the GAA. So we do have a head start, and that's why we're one of the first sports to come back out of the lockdown. And, you know, it's important we take advantage of it and the members support the clubs. And because the next 6 months, 9 months in the golf industry, I'm afraid, are going to be difficult for a lot of people and for a lot of organisations within it.
What about yourself, Paul? Did you get out to play today?
I didn't today, but I'm in London, so I'm able to. We started playing golf here last Wednesday, so I played Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I've had a day off today, and I'll resume again tomorrow. I had a few things to do today, and a few meetings I had to do, which kept me busy. But yeah, I'm managing to play every day. I mean, I live right on the golf course, so it's easy. The weather's been fabulous, and it's great. You know, it's great to get out. You play in two balls, but being able to go out and play, it's great. Yeah, certainly. We're very fortunate in our sport that we can go out and do it. But there's a lot of hurdles. I mean, you raised some great questions here in the last kind of 10 minutes about what we're going to face as lovers of sport in the coming months. And I think one thing is for sure, it's not going to be ideal. In fact, it's going to be difficult. But you know what? We'll get used to it. And the important thing is the integrity of the sport remains more than anything else. And that competitiveness returns. I think once we get that competitiveness and that edginess, I think we'll forget about the fact that the crowd is there. We'll get consumed with, you know, whether it be two teams or golfers going head to head. That really is the essence, or two jockeys coming down the straight. That's really the essence of sport. And I think we'll get used to the fact that there's no crowds and more into what the competitive environment is. And that's the real thrill that we all get from watching sport.
Well, I hope we all do, Paul. Thanks a million for taking our call.
Game on 2FM.
We have great confidence in Kenahan. We think he's very, very, very honest, very astute. He has great connections. And it appears to us, when that fight happens, let's assume Joshua beats Pulev and Fury beats Wilder in their fights that'll take place. Next year, we'll be looking for a site. US, UK, is the Mideast coming up with a very, very large number for that fight. And that's what Dan is looking into, because everybody trusts Kenahan with handling that situation, whether it's Eddie or Frank or myself. So Dan is like the captain when it comes to the practicalities of doing a fight in the Mideast.
Now, that was legendary boxing promoter Bob Arum speaking in recent days about Daniel Kenahan, whose growing profile in the boxing world is raising a lot of eyebrows and is the topic of plenty of discussions in the Irish media too. To examine why this has happened and what impact it will have on Irish boxing, we are joined by RTE crime correspondent Paul Reynolds and boxing journalist Gavin Casey from the 42. Paul, I'm going to go to you first. For those who are unfamiliar with Daniel Kenahan, could you tell us a little bit about him, please?
Well, Daniel Kenahan was identified 2 years ago in the High Court in Dublin as a senior figure in organised crime on a global scale. Now, the Criminal Assets Bureau said he controlled and managed the operations of the Kenahan Organised Crime Group. This is an organisation which smuggles drugs and guns into Ireland, the UK and mainland Europe, and has, quote, associations that facilitate international criminal activity in Europe, Asia, the Middle East and South America. That's a quote from a High Court judgment. Now, the Irish branch of the wider international Kenahan Organised Crime Group is called the Byrne Organised Crime Group. Now, it's also involved in guns and drugs trafficking, or as the High Court put it, the importation and distribution of controlled drugs and firearms within this jurisdiction. And it's led by Daniel Kinahan's close friend, Liam Byrne. Now, Liam Byrne's brother, David, was shot dead at the Regency Hotel in February of 2016 at an event organised by Daniel Kinahan's boxing promotion company, MGM, to publicise a boxing match at the National Stadium in Dublin that weekend. That murder escalated the gang's ongoing feud with the rival Hutch organised crime group, which has so far resulted in the deaths of 18 people in Ireland. Now, Daniel Kinahan attended David Byrne's funeral in Dublin alongside a who's who of Irish gangsters, many of whom, such as Freddie Thompson and Declan Brady, whose nickname is Mr. Nobody, have since been jailed. It's the last time Daniel Kinahan was seen in Dublin. He remains, as the Gardaí politely put it, a person of interest to the Garda's special crime operations unit. They would seek to interview him should he decide to come back to Ireland. The National Crime Agency and the Spanish police are also very interested in Daniel Kinahan's activities. 2 years ago, a chief investigator told a Spanish court that Daniel Kinahan had ordered the murder of Gary Hutch, who was previously a member of the Kinahan organised crime gang, and he was the first victim of the ongoing Hutch-Kinahan feud. Daniel Kinahan was also named in the High Court judgment on the 31st of July 2018 that resulted in the loss to the criminal organisation of €1.4 million of criminal assets. Now, these include houses, luxury cars, high-end jewellery, diamond rings, Rolex watches, and these were all deemed by the High Court to be the proceeds of crime. Miss Justice Carmel Stewart found that Liam Byrne was, quote, a trusted lieutenant of Daniel Kinahan and the Kinahan organised crime group.
Gavin, if we were just to move on to boxing then, when did it become clear that he was a big player in the boxing world?
It would have been around the start of the last decade, Marie, when he and a close friend of his, Matthew Macklin, who went on to challenge for a world title as a middleweight, would be a fairly renowned boxer and respected boxer in Irish and British circles. The two of them founded what was then called the MGM Gym in Portobello. It was a sort of initially stated as being almost a charitable pursuit in a way. It was going to be a community gym where children could come in, train for free, that sort of thing. It was very much publicly stated as being a non-profit organization. And from there, the management group, which is now known as NTK Global, grew. There was obviously a massive rebranding done after the Regency shooting in 2016, and it was around the time as well where the MGM Hotel casinos in Las Vegas had a bit of a legal dispute with the MGM gym in Spain. But through all of that time, really, from the start of the last decade onwards and into the now, Daniel Kinahan would have been involved in boxing to some degree. Where there would have been something resembling a cut-off point, at least again on public record, would have been in 2017, when Kinahan, it was said, had cut all ties with NTK Global, or at least NTK had cut ties with him. Sandra Vaughan, a business owner from Scotland, had essentially bought the company, and there would be no more official connection between Daniel Kinahan and NTK Global. But in more recent days, and over the last probably week or 10 days, really, as you heard at the start of the segment from Bob Arum, Daniel Kinahan has sort of re-emerged and is attempting, I think, to reinvent himself as a major player, not only in Irish boxing, but within the wider context of global boxing, where now you have some of the leading promoters in the world, many of whom will be familiar to listeners at home, the likes of Arum that we mentioned, Frank Warren, Eddie Hearn, who are sort of using him as a consultant, maybe even an advisor and a broker in their bids to make some of the biggest fights in the sport. So after probably a quiet period from Mr. Kinahan on the boxing front, he has suddenly regained an enormous level of prominence. I say regained, I mean really he's sort of catapulted himself beyond where he would have been before he left the sport, officially speaking, a couple of years ago.
Paul, it seems that there is a huge disparity between Kinahan's domestic and international reputations, just going on Bob Arum and Sandra Vaughan coming out, like two big players in the world of sport and praising him, and then, of course, his association now with Bahrain.
Yeah, the Gardaí see this as a strategy to reinvent Daniel Kinahan and portray him as a big name in global sport, in the global sport of boxing. I mean, first of all, you have Bob Arum coming out saying he met Daniel Kinahan a number of times, was very impressed with him, spent 4 or 5 days with him in Dubai, spent some time with him in Kazakhstan, where he said Kinahan was an advisor at a charity function. He referred to him as Dan. He said he's in effect Connect, his the company's advisor in the Middle East. And what was really interesting was the fact that he said that Daniel Kinahan would be very influential in securing a world boxing title fight between Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua. Now, such a global multi-million euro bout would decide the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. And that sport, that's the sport of boxing at the highest possible level. As well as that, then, a couple of days later, you have the CEO of the MTK Promotions Company, which is one of the most successful in the world at the moment, Sandra Vaughan, coming out. Now, Sandra said she doesn't do too many interviews and she's far too busy to be doing interviews. But she was also praising Daniel Kinahan. She wanted to clarify that he had no connection to the company. She insisted there was no financial relationship between MTK and Daniel Kinahan, but she said that Daniel was in fact an advisor to boxers and had recommended MTK to fighters as a management company, and she said she was very grateful for that work that Daniel Kinahan was doing. And perhaps what was most surprising of all to law enforcement, not just here but also in the UK and also in Spain, was the fact that Daniel Kinahan received an endorsement from the Royal Family of Bahrain, because KHK Sports announced that it had appointed Kinahan as a special advisor. Now, the company, we're told, is involved in boxing and mixed martial arts and was founded by His Highness Sheikh Khalid bin Hamad Al Khalifa, who is the fifth son of King Hamad, the ruler of Bahrain. And that certainly caused some surprise in law enforcement circles around Europe, because Kinahan is known to police forces in Britain, in the Netherlands, in Ireland and in Spain as a senior figure in organised crime.
And Gavin, when you look at MTK and who they have, they with Fury, Frampton, Conlon, the fact that this Joshua fight might be brokered by Kinahan, do you think that the rebranding of Daniel Kinahan is being successful or on the brink of being successful?
I suppose if you look at it again in a wider context of boxing being a sport that predominantly takes place outside of Ireland, like America is where it's at really. The Middle East is now a burgeoning area in which the sport is set to grow and where a lot of mega events will take place. Like, do people from outside of Ireland know of Daniel Kinahan's backstory, his history? Probably most of them don't. Even if they do learn of it, and Bob Arum was really frank about this when he was asked about it in an interview with John Hand and the Irish Sun, did they really care about it? Probably not. Like, it's probably not been a great 2 or 3 years for morality in a very general sense around the world. So I suppose it's distinctly possible that his bid to rebrand himself and to essentially break good or legitimize himself as a businessman and as a powerful figure within the world of boxing will go essentially unchallenged, because boxing is a pretty good sport, or at least it has a history of being able to turn a blind eye to all sorts of things. In fact, I can't think of another sport wherein a reputation can be rebuilt so rapidly. Tyson Fury, one of MTK's fighters, is a fairly strong example of that. Like, Tyson Fury a couple of years ago was reviled by many people for a number of controversial remarks he made in relation to homosexuality, discriminatory remarks against women, and so on. And MTK and his promotional companies in Top Rank, who are run by Bob Arum, and the affiliated TV networks, ESPN and BT Sport, have sort of done an amazing job in making Fury, or facilitating Fury's rehabilitation as this cherished and much beloved character in both the UK and the States. So, look, the pathway is there, I suppose. Boxing fans, I would say, are generally speaking not the most scrutinous, probably not the most judgmental, and there's so much nefariousness in the sport as it is. They probably willingly turn a blind eye to a lot of things because, you know, this is, you know, Kinahan rising to become some sort of prominent figure will just be the latest in a long line of similar stories in the sport.
Well, Sandra Vaughan, now, she did clarify in that interview over the last few days that there is no financial relationship between MTK and Daniel Kinahan, and whoever her boxers decide to associate with or are using it as an advisor is up to them. Paul, over the last few days, things escalated a little bit more. We saw a documentary land on YouTube last night, which reenacted the Regency Hotel massacre, and then graffiti as well was Sky offices were... there was graffiti on the walls there about Kinahan as well. What's the significance of these latest developments?
Yeah, these are familiar sites because last year as well, we also had some graffiti that was daubed on the walls of the Helix Theatre in Glasnevin in Dublin because Tyson Fury was due to preside over an event there and in Cork, and those events had to be cancelled because there were threats made. Also, similar threats, as you say, were daubed on the walls of Sky Television. The reason for that is because there is a perception, rightly or wrongly, of an association between MTK and Sky. I think it really relates to the fact that Sky broadcast fights that are promoted by MTK, and that graffiti and the link to Daniel Kinahan was established because Sandra Vaughan, even though she says there's no financial link, she does accept that there is a relationship between MTK and Daniel Kinahan. And remember, this feud is still going on. People are still appearing before the Special Criminal Court. Two people just pleaded guilty today to offences that are connected to feud-related activities. Last week, for the first time, the Kinahan Organised Crime Gang was publicly named in an Irish court. Detective Superintendent David Gallagher, who's 25 years' experience in dealing with organised crime in this country, described the gang. He said it had a hierarchical structure. Subcells operate to the benefit of the gang and to enhance its capabilities. He said the subcells were assigned activities from the higher level, and each subcell doesn't necessarily know what the other subcells are doing. I mean, this is akin to how a terrorist organization works. So the world of organized crime and the activities of the Kinahan organized crime gang are still very much alive in this country. They're still being their activities are still being outlined in the Special Criminal Court almost on a weekly basis as members, foot soldiers, lower down members of the Kinahan organized crime gang are being continuously sentenced for activities that are related to the ongoing feud. The Gardaí have saved 75 lives so far in cases where there have been attempts made on people's lives. Tragically, 18 people have lost their lives as a result of this ongoing feud. It shows no sign of abating. And there are also hundreds of thousands of people, not just in this country, but all over the world, that have been terribly and tragically affected by guns and drugs crime.
And the documentary last night, Paul, we saw just the reenaction of what happened in the Regency. Why was that put out last night, and what are they trying to achieve with it?
Well, again, the Gardaí see that as part of this strategy to reinvent Daniel Kinahan. I'm not saying people should. I mean, when you watch the documentary, it's really it strikes me as a combination of comedy and farce. I mean, it's very, very slickly produced. There's obviously a lot of money that has been put into it, but it makes a series of false claims. It's fake news. A lot of it. There's an awful lot of lies in it, effectively. And this is what fake news does. Fake news is put out to destabilize, to divide people, and to call into question the legitimate authorities. And in this case, this video calls into question the legitimate authority of the government and the Gardaí by peddling all sorts of false conspiracies, which simply don't stand up to a basic analysis of the facts. I mean, one claim they make is that it took 23 minutes for the Gardaí to arrive at the Regency Hotel after David Byrne was shot dead. That is simply not true. The Gardaí were there within 3.5 minutes, and when the Gardaí got there, the ambulance, the Dublin Fire Brigade ambulance, was already there.
And Gavin, just for boxing in Ireland in general, with these developments and this focus now on Daniel Kinahan, what does it mean for the future of boxing here in Ireland and just our Irish boxers?
I don't think it actually affects the future of Irish boxing, or at least it doesn't change the path that it's currently on and has been on for the last 4 years since the Regency shooting, in that big-time boxing can't take place in Dublin anyway, and that will remain the case. And the reason why big-time boxing, say a Katie Taylor homecoming, something that Katie herself, manager Brian Peters, Eddie Hearn, her promoter, are asked about constantly, it can't come to fruition in Dublin for various reasons, one of which being the fact that if it was to take place, it would take place in the Three Arena, which is down in the sort of Sherwood Street area of Dublin, generally associated with being hutch territory within the context of this gangland war. So do you then have a situation in which Eddie Hearn, who consults with Daniel Kinahan perhaps on a fight between Anthony Joshua and Tyson Fury in the Middle East, is in Dublin, in the Three Arena, in this particular part of the capital city here. And like, can you guarantee that he'll be safe? Probably not. Can you guarantee the safety of anybody at an event like that? Probably not. Generally speaking, boxing events will draw these types of characters that we probably don't like to see, or we definitely don't like to see at ringside or in an arena. So all of that really won't change. And boxing in Ireland on a grander scale has been effectively dead since 2016. The last big time event that happened here was actually a Matthew Maxton fight in 2014. November of that year. And you know, the idea of a major fight landing back in Dublin or even elsewhere in Ireland in the coming years is very, very remote. And I think, you know, there's the issue with this, I suppose, is that there, in the sport of boxing, there is no world governing body. There is no body that you can go to and say, are you aware that this is happening? Like, boxing is composed of a number of individual stakeholders, each of whom are trying to make money, and there's nobody overseeing it. So all of these questions are nearly rhetorical in a way. Like, there's you can call for people to be held accountable. Say the fighters who signed with NTK Global, the morality involved in that is questionable, but there's nobody to talk to about it. You know, nobody is overseeing this. This is just the way the sport works, and there's a sort of a feeling of helplessness about it. And it remains to be seen really how successful Mr. Kinahan's bid to reinvent himself will be. But beyond the general challenge of law enforcement in various countries, I don't really see much standing in the way of it on the boxing front.
OK, Gavin Casey of The 42 and Paul Reynolds, RTE crime correspondent, thanks so much for joining me.
Game on 2FM.
Well, the Germans may have got their soccer toes down first, but the Premier League clubs met today to decide on the return to play for their players. And to join us, we're delighted to be joined by sports journalist Fergal Brennan. Fergal, how are you?
Not too bad, yourself?
Very good. Good news today, a return to play for the Premier League players. Return to train.
It is, yeah. Obviously a big step in the right direction in terms of the Premier League returning in the next probably 6 to 8 weeks. This was a big decision. There's been a lot of talk of clubs that potentially wanted the season to be declared null and void. Obviously, there's been a lot of speculation as to who those clubs might be. But the Premier League have been quite clear on this, that a vote will be the way to decide it. They released a statement this morning saying a unanimous decision has been reached about a return to training as part of a longer process to bring in the Premier League back. So all 20 teams, all players and relevant staff will be tested in the next 48 hours. Some clubs will be returning to training on Tuesday, but the majority will be Wednesday, as it's generally between 24 and 48 hours to get a test result back. And obviously, there is a potential that there could still be clubs having to deal with positive tests and how they manage certain players self-isolating and how they then look to move forward. But in terms of training returning, it is expected to be Tuesday, Wednesday for certain clubs. I have press releases from Everton, Liverpool, Man City, Man United today. Again, there's a bit of a mix between Tuesday and Wednesday as to when they'll be returning, but there'll be no five-a-side, there'll be no game that players look forward to at the end of training sessions. It's still very much socially distanced, so it'll be drills, it'll be passing drills, it'll be rondos and some physical training, but in terms of contact between players, that's still being kept to an absolute minimum at this stage.
Is there any indication then when it'll be back playing, when we'll see Premier League and what format we'll see it in?
Yes, the Premier League have again said that this kind of stick in the sand of June the 12th is only a starting date to work from. But everyone that I've spoken to in terms of the meeting today, in terms of the official word from the Premier League, that date will be kept to, provided there's no unforeseen circumstances in the next few weeks, i.e. If the rate of positive tests that comes back are higher than the Bundesliga or La Liga, for example, that could force a rethink. And ultimately, if the logistics of getting games back is too much for the government, for the Premier League, then that will cause a rethink. In terms of fans attending games, they've pretty much knocked that on the head and said it could be up to 6 to 8 months before normal sporting attendance is anywhere back to normal in the UK, particularly football, given the size of the stadiums that are involved. But that June 12th deadline will be kept to if absolutely everything goes to plan in the next few weeks. But as we know, dealing with coronavirus and particularly sport during coronavirus, that can be very difficult. I would probably expect it to be kicked on another week, maybe 2 weeks. I think the end of June is more likely. But the 12th of June will be the date they're working to at the moment.
Fergal, there wasn't really any surprises in the statements that were released. Much of the protocols that the Premiership are putting in place were what the Bundesliga have in place. Do you think that they will just basically follow what the Bundesliga have done?
I think, for all intents and purposes, yeah, you're dead right there. The Bundesliga is obviously the example that we all looked at this weekend, and everything went off quite well. There was no issues in terms of the games, the matches, the players. There didn't seem to be any issues over the weekend or today in terms of news coming out of Germany. And yeah, I think Spain will also be an example that the Premier League will be looking to follow. This idea of constant testing of players, obviously the situation in Spain is going to be mirrored in the UK, which will be that if a player does test positive, they have to then submit two negative tests before they can return to training. So clubs right the way across the board are not taking any shortcuts on this. Testing will be constant. And there's also talk that when games do come back, players will be tested on the morning of games. And obviously the results will be turned around quite quickly. If there's a negative test, then those games will potentially be called off. So there's still a huge amount to be done. But yeah, I think the Bundesliga, the way they've done it, is an example to leagues across Europe. And I think the Premier League will be kind of looking over the fence and going, they've got it right. Can we match this? And can we ensure that we're not taking any unnecessary risks?
Obviously, Fergal, the Scottish Premier League went for a completely different road and they have finished their division. Celtic have been crowned champion for the ninth year in a row, but Hearts have been relegated. And there is some murmurs that Hearts may seek legal action. Can you see that happening?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, whether it's right or wrong in terms of the Scottish League or the English League or any league, when a season is either declared null and void or it's points per games, as was the case in Scotland, the winners and the losers are obviously going to have completely different views on this. And Hearts are obviously the big losers in this. They've issued a statement today, as you say, to say they're considering legal action. And I think that will be the case in situations where leagues have not ended in a natural way. Even if this is the right decision, Hearts did vote for the end of the season, but obviously they didn't vote for it to be decided by points per game or to be relegated or relegation exist or European places exist, etc. But I think clubs will always look to maybe go down the legal route if they've got grounds, and they do have grounds here. Whilst they voted for this, technically in the eyes of, you know, the legal position from sport, they do have grounds to push this. And there is precedent for this, that the famous case with Sheffield United and West Ham, when Carlos Tevez scored a goal to send them down. They got relegated, had financial issues, and they sued the Premier League, and the Premier League paid out, I think it was £35 million to Sheffield United in legal costs. So Hearts do have a case, and I think they will push for this. Just because it seems to be the most logical way to end the season doesn't mean that those clubs that lose out are just going to kind of leave it and roll on into next season.
We saw Celtic tweet and celebrate after they were awarded champions. Is that the right thing to do, do you think, Fergal?
Again, it's very difficult to gauge in terms of the right answers. Obviously, I've got hundreds and hundreds of Celtic fans who follow me on social media and friends and family that are obviously delighted. 9 in a row, pushing for 10 in a row next season. I personally think the way they've handled it has been quite classy. I don't think they've rubbed it in or they've over-egged it. They have just won a league title, albeit in the strangest way possible. I don't think it's too much. No, I think they've handled it quite well, particularly their social media stuff. And their handling of the situation during coronavirus has been quite good. They've been happy to leave it in the hands of the league. And, you know, you can be a little bit cynical and say that's because they know that more than likely they're going to be given the title. But I don't think they've particularly acted untoward in all of this. And you do have to cut Celtic. You know, Neil Lennon's obviously done an interview today. You do have to cut them a bit of slack. They have just won a league title. Yes, I know there's far bigger things going on at the moment, but you do have to allow some sort of celebration.
Neil Lennon gave a favourable mention to Damien Duff as well in his statement afterwards.
He did indeed, and obviously Duff is going to play a key role with Stephen Kenny now, and he's really highly rated at Celtic. You know, anyone that I've spoken to, a friend of mine covers Celtic quite regularly, and he said that, you know, they were a little bit miffed to see him go. Obviously, working with the Irish national team is a big dream for Duffer to be involved in that. And he's a former player that he seems to be one of the names that everyone always kind of says, oh, yeah, he'll be one. You know, in the kind of the Arteta story when he took over at Arsenal, that he was high-flying in his way for exams. And Duffer has a similar situation. And I think Celtic will obviously wish him well. And hopefully Celtic's loss will be Ireland's gain in the next few months.
Well, we'll certainly be hoping it is, Fergal. Thanks a million.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Thanks, Fergal. Ruby, we've a text in. You're missing Dunica's point on the return of the Bundesliga. He said, in his opinion, it's too clinical, and he's right. He never said he was against sport without crowds.
Sport is clinical. It's about winning. Come on, Marie. You know that as well as I do.
That was from Mario Callahan. Ruby, there's one here, and it's come in twice. Ask Ruby, will Lestal be on?
Lestal. We don't know what's going to happen in July, and someone wants to know, will Lestal in September be on? I'm sure it will be on. Will there be a crowd there? Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay, lads, that is all we have time for. Lee Keegan, Mayo Star, will be with us tomorrow. Very excited about that.
Game on 2FM.